we'll have a pledge of allegiance. Greg, why don't you lead us in the pledge today?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, Greg. Are there any added agenda items? Public comment at this time? Hearing none. Discussion on Project Wildfire. And I'm going to believe that we can ask our guests to introduce themselves.
Yes, it's a work session, so this is not formal. So you can have more back and forth, obviously, questions. It's a discussion, not a formal type. There's no motions here, none of that stuff. So
ladies first.
I'm Allison Green. I'm the program coordinator for Project Wildfire.
And Ed Keith with Deschutes County. I'm the county forester.
So with that, I brought all kinds of pretty
and
pictures.
And who's this young gentleman?
I'm next on the agenda.
Oh, are you? Okay.
Nathan Garaby. Yep.
Well, you can go ahead and introduce yourself.
Nathan Garaby. I'm the county emergency services manager.
I thought so. All right, great.
I was just so excited to present that I left poor Nathan out. So I brought Ed and I here both to give you all an update on the new Community Wildfire Protection Plan for Lapine, and also a little bit of background and kind of an overview of what I do. I know a lot of folks see Project Wildfire and Fire Free in the news, but they're not quite sure what that entails for me. So for starters, I'm going to pass around some maps, and these are actually the maps that we're using for that Community Wildfire Protection Plan. Take one if you would like, they're extras. And I did bring plans with me in case folks want a copy in a binder. It looks like most of you may have the giant document in front of you. But if you would like one, please let me know. I do have a copy. And then, before I kick anything else off, I did bring quick little trifold brochures, one on Project Wildfire, essentially what we do as an organization, and then on Fire Free, which are those spring, fall debris drop days at the transfer sites in the landfill. So I don't know if you folks really want these to go on just in case.
Okay.
So for Project Wildfire background, we are a Deschutes County organization. We actually are governed by a 27-member steering committee that has a balanced mix between fire agency personnel and other local businesses, HOA members. So our goal is to prevent deaths, injuries, property loss, and environmental damage due to wildfire in Deschutes County. So some of my main jobs when I kind of run around here is organizing the Fire Free Days, which especially the spring event, it's a countywide event, and also is now in Jefferson County as well. Supporting any new FireWise communities and existing communities. So those are typically communities that have taken it upon themselves to address their wildfire preparedness on a neighborhood level. So we try to get them the resources they need, help with any fuel reduction if we have any assistance available, and mainly help them try to get organized. And then educational outreach, so coming to things like this, getting folks ready for fire season, teachable moments during fire season, and then of course community wildfire protection plans. We have 7 that encompass Deschutes County. They actually, having 7, it splits Deschutes County to a much personal level, so folks don't have to get together. Folks in Lapine aren't talking about wildfire risk in Redmond and vice versa. It's a way for Lapine to take on their wildfire risk and discuss it all around the table with HOA members, business members, fire agencies, everybody that is involved. So we typically act as the facilitator and the preparer of these documents. We mainly act as the objective party to capture all of the input from the local folks and make sure that we are able to write that in a way that will direct and advise future fuel treatment, not only on federal land, but on private land as well. So it helps direct federal projects, myself and where to write grants, where to possibly pursue some fuel reduction. And then I will actually, I'll kick it off to Ed because he can give you a background with CWPPs much better than I can.
Yeah, so Allison was just going to start you off with what is Project Wildfire. I was going to give you a little bit on what is a community wildfire protection plan. So it just kind of puts it in context if you haven't been familiar with plans in the past. So community wildfire protection plans were first envisioned coming when they came out of the Healthy Forest Restoration Act, which passed in 2003. So it was a federal bill that passed. Part of that said that basically encourage, it doesn't mandate that communities have wildfire protection plans, but encourage communities to collaborate and write these community wildfire protection plans that identified where wildland urban interface issues are from a fire perspective. And then it does state that once those plans are in place, one of the things is it directs the federal land management agencies, and so in our case the BLM, and the Forest Service to dedicate at least half of their fuel reduction dollars to priorities that are identified in these plans. And then it also does make the local communities, the state forestry agency, the county, that sort of thing, eligible for application for funding to implement the things that are identified in this plan as well and try to work on the priority areas. So basically, if a community chooses to write the plan, then basically there's three required elements. One is that it requires collaboration, so it's a collaborative effort. It's not just a county writing a plan or a city writing a plan or the state forestry agency writing a plan, but it's bringing together all the interested stakeholders to collaborate on a plan together. That the plan then includes what the community's priorities are for fuel reduction, and that there's a plan to address structural ignitability in there as well. So those are the really three required elements. You can have a lot of other things in the plan, so our plans have grown over the years. This is actually the third iteration of the Greater Lapine Community Wildfire Protection Plan. We try to update those plans at least every 5 years, and so that we're capturing what work has got done over the last 5 years and how that might have changed our priorities so that we can keep that plan fresh and off the shelf and it's not just something that we write and forget about. So trying to keep it fresh, bringing the people to the table and just having those discussions on how are our priorities changing, what projects are we getting done, where do we want to go in the future. So that's the basic Community Wildfire Protection Plans 101. I think then Allison was just going to talk a little bit about this particular revision.
So this, as Ed alluded to, this is a third iteration. So the original CWPP was actually written in 2005. There was actually kind of an initial push in Deschutes County. There were two plans that kind of came out right about that same time, and neither group were all that happy with it, so they redid it, and then everybody else, and so that's kind of actually how we came up with the seven. But so then it was actually revised in 2010, and so this was kind of the second revision or the third version of it. Some pretty exciting stuff. I mean, to me, I mean, I'm kind of a CWPP nerd, so bear with me. But this year, one of the big things that we did was we incorporated, it's a big, long acronym, but the short version of it is Cohesive Strategy, is the National Cohesive Wildfire Management Strategy. This is a way to address the all hands, all lands kind of approach. So, you know, we all know wildfire is not just feds, it's not just state. It is everybody's problem. It goes across whatever borders, wherever it is. So this is the first of its kind. It was a pilot. I'm very, very happy with it. The community seems very happy with it. So it addresses three goals. So a more resilient landscape, a more fire-adapted community, and improved fire response. So when all three of those come together, we see essentially the magic that happened in Burgess Road. Also, one thing that we included in this is this base map that's in front of you here with kind of the big blocks of color. Those are used as rating areas. So we use those to do a risk assessment. So a lot of factors go into that. Defensible space, a lot of infrastructure values at risk, roads, structural ignitability. And so we use those to prioritize these areas. This year we actually put the city of Lapine as its own rating area. When this plan was initially written in 2005, the city of Lapine was not incorporated. So the city, when we looked at the base map, it was divided into four quadrants, which was not going to work anymore. There's infrastructure and significant values at risk here just in the city. So we moved that around. And I think we included not many structures, but a lot of land kind of out near the Wickiup area and the Finley Butte area, kind of out Highway 31, that a lot of land that didn't have any risk rating numbers associated with it to begin with. So we got some new rating areas, some new numbers, some way to actually assess those, which helps us apply for grants and helps us direct that fuel treatment. And so I wanted to more, in the action plan, and let's look. Since I have a binder, let's use it. So we have the action plan. It begins on page 39, and that is where we look at those three goals in depth. So what action plan items are going to make Lapine a more resilient community on a landscape scale? What's going to make Lapine a more fire-adapted community? And what action items are going to improve our fire response? So folks can turn to, 39 and be like, okay, so what are folks doing to improve our fire response? What are we doing to work towards a more fire-adapted community here in Lapine and in some of the outlying areas that just surround the city of Lapine? So the action items, there's also a table in there that talks about how to create effective defensible space and how to reduce structural vulnerability. So if you have a resident who goes on to Project Wildfire's website and is like, having to make my home safer, they go to page 37 and it's right there for them in an easy checklist. Rather than them having to read all 90 some odd pages of this, you can flip to that page and apply it right there on their residence. So, and we also wanted to bring up some pretty exciting stuff. Now that we are moving on to some of the third revisions of these plans, we're starting to see them pay off. The Burgess Road fire was actually a really great example of seeing fuel treatment come forward and actually act as something to slow down the fire and able to improve fire response and kind of that whole three-goal approach. We saw it happen in Burgess Road. So in 2013, and I'm sure everybody is way more familiar with this fire than I am, we had that fire ignited by a wind event. It hit some county-owned land that had been mowed in 2004 and then 2009, and that was under the direction of the CWPPs. And once that fire hit that fuel treatment, it slowed down. Folks were able to actually attack it with a direct attack and slow the fire down and stop it. And then another, it was exciting for the community members. We have especially two neighborhoods who are super involved in these community wildfire protection plans, Ponderosa Pines and Newberry Estates. When this plan was originally drafted, they were number one and two on the list. They were, one of the highest risks. Now they are lower on the list at four and five. And so through these plans, they were able to plan around their community. Ponderosa Pines is a brand new FireWise community. So they are starting to take those steps to make some changes. And then we actually may have some potential funding for these projects that were named in the action plan currently. We have some very specific areas that the steering committee brought up. I think there's actually a parcel that's right next to the high school that would be an excellent demonstration lot. It would be visible. Folks could see what ladder fuel reduction looks like on the ground and maybe help keep some high schoolers out of trouble. So there might be some pretty exciting funding opportunities down here in this area. We always do try to stick with the priorities in this plan, so whatever is rated 1, 2, and 3, we do the outreach there first, and then we, if we don't get any feedback, then we go back to the drawing board and do some more outreach. So then I figured I would leave time for questions. I know this is a big cumbersome plan if you haven't dealt with it before. What questions are there?
Well, thinking for myself, the new neighborhood got mowed in 2004, mm-hmm. 2009, mm-hmm. and it's 2015. So you know, it was a good thing that it had been mowed, and it did contribute to the success of the whole event. Will we see it get mowed again soon?
Probably will. Actually, you know, obviously part of it only because it recently burned. Sure. We did actually do a small treatment immediately adjacent to the Crescent Creek community just this summer. We did somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 or 10 acres that's directly adjacent. So we will continue to maintain that treatment over time, especially around any of the homes that border that property. Yeah.
Are you running a cat line around that, or are you just kind of go out to make a fire break for them, or no?
No, you know, they have the paved roads that kind of surround the community, so it's more just about so the brush that comes back is bitter brush,
right?
The most highly flammable fuel that we have in Central Oregon, and so basically the objective is to keep it mowed down to the point where if a fire should happen, it would produce flame lengths of 4 feet or less, and so if you have that kind of fire behavior, you can directly attack the fire without it you know, requiring extra air resources or that sort of thing. So that's the general strategy, just to manage the fuels in a way that they might burn, but it's not going to be something that is very difficult to extinguish.
What about, because some of us toured the area right after, and your predecessor talked about salvage,
mm-hmm.
if any of that was salvageable, and then because it was so high, evidently the cones, the seedlings from the cones, how much of a problem is that going to be in the future? Is that going to require more thinning?
It probably will. So we did do a salvage of the material that we could market. I have since then also allowed some limited wood cutting out there for some of the stuff that wasn't really marketable, but it could be usable for firewood. And basically what we'll do then is after about 5 years, we'll and actually required by the Department of Forestry that we have some level of stocking in there, we'll do some kind of stocking survey and say, where do we have too many trees, where might we actually not have enough, and then go from there. But yeah, that'll be something that we monitor over the years.
And then is one of your pumping stations, was that located?
It's outside the fire, but it's pretty close.
It was close by.
Okay. Cool. And you saved that, so our people are grateful for that.
Yeah. Luckily, most of the infrastructure on that property is underground, so.
I mean, that's probably the only place in the middle of the city that you'd have a big one that could start in and go out. The rest, our threat is
from the outside.
Is the outside coming in. I mean, it's the forest fire that's rolling, coming in at us. You know, it's so hard for us to get one big enough in the city to, you know, can bother a couple, three neighbors, but by and large, it's going to. So,
yeah.
It's all these stuff around us is where our real threats are.
We have seen some progress on that, in particular. A lot of the BLM lands that are around here, if I think back to the first land I was involved with, and you know, over 10 years, we've seen a lot of that actually treated by the BLM, and it's or being treated actually as, you know, basically as we speak, through their Lapine project that they have broken up into different contract areas. So
another area would be the Cahill subdivision, just because it's 1 and 2 acre lots. And people tend to have a lot of fuels around because they stack their wood and they have all their chicken coops and their cars and their sear snow, Leshwab snow tires and everything else stacked around the sear shed, and they have tires on it and hold the roof down. So that's where the fire could get, and you could, you know, kind of get around several of them because you got gravel roads, narrower, mature trees.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody over there hardly has limbed anything up. So there's really nothing. So I think that's, and then you kind of have, like, say, narrow roads going and coming out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see that as a a threat. Places where you live, you know, one in you could just sit in your yard and watch it go by. You know.
What about that being private land now? Where, how far would grants and stuff like that go to work in to some place like Hagel?
So typically our grants are what we term sweat equity. So it is, there has to be some sort of investment on that homeowner or HOA, depends on their part. So whether that's man hours, you know, they pull the brush to the road and we hire somebody to haul it away or chip it, you know, or sometimes, you know, we typically don't like to do it this way. We like the folks to go out and have some ownership in it, but sometimes financially matching as well with the grant so that there is some investment, some ownership. And those are, they're really cost effective, and honestly, it gets some really great neighborhood participation and neighborhood ownership in it. And a lot of times the haul to the road is incredibly successful, and the neighborhoods, I mean, they see that as, oh, well, that wasn't, I mean, that was barely any money at all, you know, and they'll set up their own sweat equity projects. So a lot of our grants, they do call for investment from the folks that are receiving them.
But they can be applied on mm-hmm. on private land for the ones
okay.
that we have. We just are looking for trying to engage at a neighborhood level instead of, okay, you want to participate, but your three neighbors don't,
right.
and one over here,
right.
and that's so
is that
get a whole neighborhood on board. What's that?
Is that difficult?
Or you've got in some
three,
places it is,
you know, and you've got one, and
yeah, I mean, and you know, if we. We don't have to have necessarily 100% of the neighborhood, but we definitely don't want to just have kind of what I term as the Swiss cheese approach, where it's like we're just make one little hole here, and then you have to go two or three blocks before you find somebody else that wants to participate. But if, you know, if we get half the people to participate at least in you know, making their community safer, then we can definitely look at providing some assistance. And typically, one of the big barriers is, okay, we did this project, what do we do with all this material? And so that's where we can help out with a contractor, you know, with a chipper or something like that to get rid of the material.
So do you chip bitter brush? I mean, you pile it out the side of the road and then you go and chip it and,
yep.
and then haul it off?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you haul it to?
It depends on the project. In the past, we've been lucky enough to find markets for the biomass. That hasn't been the case in the last year or two, but it's typically something that we try to work out with the contractor on a kind of site-specific basis. How much are we going to have? What type of material are we going to have? That sort of thing. In some communities, you know, it's kind of a win-win because they might have a trail system or common areas they're worried about dust abatement on, and so we might actually chip and make it available as a mulch to different folks too. So it just it kind of just depends on the particular neighborhood and what we
okay.
work out.
Okay.
What do you do like in our area where most of where we live it's developed, but then like the four blocks or two blocks behind us aren't, and it's full of bitter brush and like on Bassett and those. How do we do that when so far he's been unable to participate?
And that, you know, the troublesome but also the fun part about this is that this is a grassroots effort. So even FireWise, even the sweat equity projects, you know, you get as many folks on board as you can. I mean, and that's everybody from having one bag of pine needles to folks completely clearing their vacant lot. So we do the best we can to educate, you know, and I have all kinds of flyers,
yeah.
and outreach materials that I can develop. I can call folks. But, you know, typically when it is that grassroots neighbor-to-neighbor conversation about it, it's a lot more successful, even, you know, myself, you know, even being a resident of Pine, calling the second Project Wildfire comes out of my mouth, oh, you're an agency. And I mean, that's not just Pine, that's everywhere. So it is that grassroots program where folks can talk neighbor to neighbor.
Yeah.
Is more successful.
Yeah. You're talking more about the empty properties, mm-hmm. right? That never get
yeah.
mowed.
Yeah, and we were told.
Is there a liability factor there?
Started cleaning up that mm-hmm. we couldn't do that because it's private property.
Right. Mm-hmm. So is there any liability factor, you know, for people that neglect their land and just leave it open to a
Yes,
spreading wildfire.
I'll leave that one to Ed. That's a sticky one.
I hate to answer it with "it depends," but it depends. Yeah. So there's a and one of the maps we provided, it actually in the legend, it shows Senate Bill 360 reading. So there is a statewide law called, and we commonly call it Senate Bill 360 because it's got a really long title otherwise, but relating to requiring fuel management on private property, and the level of management of the fuels depends on their rating. So if you're rated as high density extreme, the vacant lots actually, you do have to, you are required to create fuel breaks. The lower ratings for vacant lots, it isn't required, although we usually still suggest it. If then people don't do that work, if they're required to, they can potentially be held liable for suppression costs, and probably it would depend on, a civil suit or something like that. But if you were required by state law to do something and you didn't, you probably could have that burden of proof that there. But so that's what's out there on a statewide basis.
Does that have a lot size with that in all that wording, I'm assuming?
The way that things are rated are based on the lot size. So if they're for Senate Bill 360 to apply at all, there's got to be at least four structures per 40 acres. So you have to have some minimum level of density. And then the ones that are high density extreme are typically, I'd say, less than 2 acres.
Do those rules apply inside incorporated city?
They do.
Okay.
They do. And that law is administered by the Oregon Department of Forestry. And so they basically send out, and it's really is intended to be more educational than anything else, but there is a required action that you're supposed to take. So they send out, here's what you need to do based on your rating area. They give people a certain amount of time to certify that they've done it, give them a checklist. They're supposed to mail that card back and certify that, yep, we've done the work. And that's been in place. Actually, the law passed in 1997. Deschutes County was one of the first two counties in Oregon to implement it, so it's been implemented on a county-by-county basis through the state. And since we have such a high risk here, we were one of the first two. I think Jackson County was the other one in southwest Oregon to implement that. So we've actually had two go-arounds with mailing that out and trying to raise it. And it, we still have ways to go, but we're definitely better off than we were before we started it. So,
to touch more on, it does have a cost liability to it, but it is, the reason it's unique is it gives the state of Oregon a common definition to work off of a defensible space. And so that's that educational piece along with it. In this action plan, the community and the stakeholders, they brought up quite a few concrete action items that we're going to tackle for education in the Lapine area. Karen, the new director of Lapine Park and Rec, is very excited about maybe developing a volunteer pool or something like that that can help with fuel reduction. So there are some things that we will be working on in the next 5 years between now and hopefully accomplishing before the next revision, but definitely working on them down here. It's going to be a two-pronged approach, and definitely education is one of those key prongs.
So on your biomass sites, there's one located out William Foss that turned out, because it's voluntary, correct? Mm-hmm. People can bring their yard debris and dispose of it and bring a chipper in and they chip it. But I think this one was shut down because of all the other stuff that wound up in it.
They were all shut down.
Yeah, they
all were?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Folks, unfortunately, were using them for not their intention, and so they had to be shut down because there just wasn't folks that could monitor them, unfortunately. So,
yeah, we still offer the in the spring before fire season in May, the chance for folks to drop that off in a more regulated environment at the transfer stations, and that's something that we're going to continue to do. We collect huge amounts of debris somewhere in the neighborhood of 30,000 yards during the month of May throughout the county and trying to get people to be prepared for fire season. That's something we're going to continue, but it really has to be in a site that we can monitor. If we are able to develop markets, it could be expanded to other dates as well, but we're definitely going to at least maintain get prepared. You know, May is a good month. Usually the snow's off the ground, people are thinking about spring cleanup anyway. Now the snow's off the ground in January.
People do it right now.
What snow? Yeah. But anyhow, that's the idea behind that fire-free effort is take the month of May to be prepared before fire season starts. And
I know the advertising hits the Bend metro area big time. Is there any other advertising we can do down here?
I typically hit all of the newspapers and a lot of the local radio stations, but I will bring down flyers and hit it down here quite a bit. And those dates, at least for the Southwest Transfer Station, are May 15th and 16th. So I will be, you actually will probably be seeing me in about a couple weeks with flyers and some initial outreach. And then as we get closer, you'll be seeing me more and more doing a lot of outreach down here.
And the radio station will be running pretty soon too.
Yes. Yeah, the second that initial press release comes out, I swear it barely hits RL's desk before he's like, whoop, dates. So luckily, you know, our radio partners and a lot of our media partners are really great about picking that up and getting the word out, at least on local stations.
We have a city cleanup day here, mm-hmm. the second Saturday in June. First Saturday.
So whenever you have it.
No, I learned the hard way. You can't compete down here for dates, and I've got it to the first Saturday in June.
Okay.
I know 1 year, and that's been going on for 4 years. We haul off a lot of bitter brush. A lot of material gets hauled out of the city and some properties I know we took it one time to, and I think it's Tim.
Shipkin.
Yeah, he always gives us through and gets supported by Wilderness Garbage mm-hmm. to haul it to the transfer station. And is there some rule about not dumping it in the in where all the brush and all of that goes? Because 1 year they wouldn't let us do it. And I think it was, I almost want to say it was last year, because they said it spreads, you know, it'll get
put out. Oh, so it includes noxious weeds, probably? Is that the
case? Yeah, but the bitter brush, too. They made us dump them in the big trailers, also.
You have to find out the particulars on that from Tim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Well, that was more than likely the intended.
Yeah, I mean, there was no way for us to get around that
right.
on that Saturday other than to accept his word that we couldn't do it, and we'd been doing it for, you know, the 3 years before that. So it was just...
Okay. Yeah, I'll have to check on the particulars of that. So, I don't know if there's any other questions. One of the provisions of the CWBP is that the folks that are signatories to the plan are actually the local fire district, the state forest management agency, which in our case in Oregon is the Oregon Department of Forestry, and local governments. So that includes both city and county, and so. The ask would be if you're accepting of the plan, we would love to get a signature from the mayor.
We can trouble you for about six signatures.
I think what we'd be glad to do it. You know, I say that, bring it before the council on our first meeting in February.
Okay. We just need to get it to us. You don't need to come back.
Yeah.
Just get it to us. You, this is your place to ask the questions. We just put it on the consent agenda and have it
signed.
Patty Nash will make sure that we have it on the next agenda. Patty's making a note. And then just make sure the document's here.
Okay. And when will that February meeting be so I can make sure?
Second Wednesday.
Okay. Whatever that is.
The 11th.
After the Burgess fire, we had one resident in Huntington Meadows that their insurance dropped them. So how closely related do they watch these things, or what? How does that all work? They were the only one that I heard of, but they called it too extreme and dropped them.
From what I hear, apparently that kind of happens in a cyclical pattern. And so, we, at least personally, I know our insurance company came out and did an assessment. Some insurance companies are. And I know myself, Oregon Department of Forestry, Sun River's environmental director that does their ladder fuel reduction, a lot of times residents will call us and be like, hey, my insurance company just told me if I don't remove, this, and this, is that accurate? So insurance companies are starting to take notice. I don't know if it might have been due to the Burgess Road, I'm not sure. I actually got a call from the environmental director in Sun River, and she just called me and she goes, so heads up, we just got another round of, State Farm letters. So I'm not quite sure what the timing is, if it was just sheer luck, but it may have been tied to the event.
Yeah.
What insurance company did they have, did you know?
That's what I was trying to remember, because they just went in and dropped everything, and they were up, the insurance company tried to keep them, and they said, not if you're not going to cover it. And they said it was because of the fire. It's on your block, the pastor.
Oh, what?
Esther.
Yeah, Esther and
Harold.
Harold.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I don't know how they found out, or if the company watches, or somehow got wind of the fire.
No, it's a couple of miles from our neighborhood. That's odd that they would drop them for that fire. Mm-hmm. And odds. I mean, what's the chance of it even leaping to Huntington Meadow from anywhere
in town? They were
back
in New York.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
they have no clue.
So there have been some cases where I know Department of Forestry, as well as myself, have gone out and basically looked at a particular property and given the landowner a letter saying there's a statewide law, Senate Bill 360. You're required to do these things. You've done these things. You meet the requirement of the law. So at least there's something, whether the insurance company decides to accept that or not, but at least it's based on, here's a requirement in state law. These people are meeting this, or not, so it's not something that just is particular to La Pine. That's happened in other parts of the county as well. It does every once in a while. So.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Anybody? Great.
Okay. We appreciate your time.
Yes.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
We'll get that to us. We'll get that on our agenda.
Okay, so, this time of year, when these plans are completed, these just go with me everywhere I go in case I run into someone.
We'll get a couple other signatures and bring it back by.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
That's a great one.
We'll probably stick
around and listen to it. We just have to approve it, and you can bring any time for him to sign it.
Okay.
Sure. Great.
Well, good evening. Thanks for inviting me, and about time I made it down. I've been in the job a little over a year, and spent quite a bit of time in La Pine, but just not at a city council meeting, so this is an important step for me. A little bit about myself. I actually started my law enforcement career in La Pine as a patrol deputy, and spent about 3 years down here, so it's kind of fun to come back and visit. I work out of the Bend office now, but I took a little hiatus to Red PD for 10 years, so that's where I disappeared off into. I'll talk a little bit about our emergency management program and then opportunities for some collaboration between the county and the city of La Pine. The Sheriff's Office provides an all-risk, all-hazards emergency management program for the entire county, so that includes all cities. We coordinate that role. Doesn't mean we can do everything. It's a one-man shop, so in a lot of communities, a lot of people that take our attention, but typically we do provide help coordinate a lot of the large-scale responses in the county, and obviously worked with folks like Ed and then all the public safety and public health and public works agencies. And so really want to talk about some opportunities, and I'll give you a little bit of I printed out just our draft budget narrative for our program, and just going to highlight a few things that kind of tie directly to Lapine. We recently completed some updates to our county's emergency operations plan, which is sitting downtown at county admin waiting to get signed off by the county commissioners. And so there's some opportunities there maybe to offer some guidance to City of Lapine if you're interested in an emergency operations plan. Ed and I both also are currently the co-chairs, although I think Ed's going to retire from that role, on our Deschutes County Natural Hazards Mitigation Plan. And this is actually an important year because, one, we're updating that plan as required by FEMA, which is a requirement for pre-disaster mitigation funds through FEMA. Some of the fuel reduction projects may be a result of those funds. And then other projects, you know, whether it's flood or some counties have utilized it for utility resiliency. So Harney Electric in the Burns area has utilized that to help improve their resiliency of their power system, which might be one of those things we might want to evaluate here, especially in South County, because that is one of your more common events that happen down here. But we're also, this is the first time that the cities have embarked upon creating a city-specific addendum, which is kind of a new, or at least explanation from FEMA is now it's required for cities, incorporated cities, to have a city-specific addendum to be eligible for pre-disaster mitigation funds. So we actually have a project in the city of Bend that Ed's working on that hinges on getting the city of Bend's natural hazard mitigation plan addendum done. So we're working on that. Bill Adams is the City of Lapine point person on that. I think we'll be scheduling some meeting in City of Lapine next month with our contractor, which is Oregon Partnership for Disaster Resilience out of Eugene. And then another interesting thing is, and I think this is really important for local governments to consider, is we're starting down the road developing a county continuity of operations plan. That essentially is what happens when the bad day comes, and how do you continue to deliver services? How do you take care of your employees and their families, ensure that they can come to work? How do you get fuel for your vehicles? How do you, you know, all those things that really ensure that when the bad day happens, government can still come to work and get the job done. And so we'll be rolling that out. Hopefully, I was hoping to do it this early, you know, first half of 2015, but we're actually partnering with all the counties in the state to get one vendor to help us with that project. So the RFP is taking longer than expected, so don't know what the timeline is on that. But we'll certainly roll that out, make that available to City of Lapine when that's out and ready, so, and get some training for you if you want to take part in that.
That sounds good.
It's actually probably one of the single biggest things governments can do right now to make themselves disaster resilient. So, and it's probably, I would say, universally around the country, one of the weak spots that we just haven't done as good a job in that as we should. And then we're really working hard with all the school districts, Bend Lapine, to develop school emergency operations plans. We held an active shooter exercise here in Lapine last spring. It was a very good exercise. It was mainly Sheriff's Office and Lapine Fire, but we brought in Sun River and Crescent and some of the other mutual aid agencies, and then as well as other law enforcement agencies, to really test the system and how we can respond to that event, especially in a rural area like this. You know, larger urban areas, you get a lot more stuff a lot faster, so we have to a little bit probably modify our tactics to ensure that we can still save lives and do an effective job of incident management with a slower roll-up of resources. I just want to talk about, we had two exercises that with active shooter, and then we also worked with the Deschutes National Forest hosted a fire simulation last spring too in Lapine that was a wildland fire-based simulation. It was a very interesting exercise. And with that, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Natural Hazard Mitigation Plan, just give you an idea of our risk. So we sat down in December and updated our Deschutes County Hazard Analysis, and I would suspect that Lapine will fit pretty closely in this, although we will do a specific one for the City of Lapine as part of the city-specific addendum. But not surprisingly, for Deschutes County, winter storm actually came in at number one hazard rank by points. And that really has to do with the countywide basis, the population at risk. So if you have a significant winter storm and it affects the entire county, whereas a wildland fire typically will affect a region of the county. Wildland fire was number two, not surprisingly, and not far behind. Number three is our potential risk associated with the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake off the coast of Oregon. We'd be happy to answer questions about that if you have any questions. I'm not going to go into that specifically, unless you want me to. And then number four is windstorm, which probably will be a little higher on that list for Lapine just because of the geography and the type of trees you have, and then the potential we get those downslope winds off of those the Cascades, and really routinely have wind events. It seems like especially in the fall. So I would suspect those will be pretty consistent across the county plan to the Lapine plan. But so I thought that was a little bit interesting to point out, kind of give you a little bit of background for kind of some of the risks we're looking at. We do have riverine flooding, but probably for the city of Lapine, you know, Little Deschutes can flood. That's something that folks around here are fairly used to. It has pretty high flows fairly regularly, but one thing that we did run into last February was what they call aerial flooding, and that was based on a rain on snow event. So ground's frozen, snow, rain on top of it. So that's where you deal with your stormwater and where that goes and, you know, the mess that makes. And we had that pretty universally around the entire county last February when we had all the snow. Interestingly enough, I was sitting in we're talking about snow in January. I was sitting in a drought council meeting. Actually, I was on the phone. It was a teleconference. On February 7th last year, and we're talking about drought, you know, declarations of drought, and I look outside the window and there's snow starts coming down, and that, I think that was the weekend we had about 2 or 3 feet throughout the county, so you just never know. So that's the beauty of Central Oregon. So really, I just kind of wanted to highlight a little bit about the program, talk about what we're doing and what kind of resources we have available to you, and then just open up for discussion questions, and just wanted to make sure that you recognize the resource you have in us. So.
I think what I get from these folks is fire, number one, because that's visible. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone likes a fire, and they hate a fire. But it's just funny how that all works.
Right.
But
it's like a train wreck.
Yeah. So that gets them all going.
Yeah.
And then you open up an emergency operations center, and I guess you do that, you're in charge of that, and all of it. What is there a role for the city? What should that role be? And, you know, from... You know, the Red Cross sets something up, and you know, we don't have a fire department, nor do we have a law enforcement agency. We have public works. We have three guys, one old dump truck, and a backhoe.
Yeah.
So that means, you know, I always try to tell them, you know, whatever our role is, will be proportional.
Yeah. No, I think that's the right way to look at it. And so I think what you do in emergency is what you do day to day as a typical rule. Obviously, we run into events like flood events are kind of an anomaly because lots of times it doesn't really fall into anybody's bailiwick. You know, we ran into that city of Bend, they had an ice issue, started to flood some homes, which are historically in a floodplain. But, you know, you have one agency show up and go, well, you know, we don't own the river, what are we going to do about it? You know, another agency, well, we don't own it either. And, you know, but the reality of it is, you know, there's kind of that give and take, you know, we do what we can to help protect people's lives and property. Obviously, life safety is number one, but I think what you do every day is what you'd be expected to be primary for on a in an emergency. So Public Works has a role. Now, I think you have pretty good cooperative agreement with County Road Department. So when you've matched your resources, essentially what we call it to public safety, we refer to it as mutual aid. You'd ask for mutual aid from Tom Schamberger at Road Department, and you'd get what they give you, and then when they're done, they'd call we'd call the state and try to just bring in resources to support you. So fire, yeah, the city doesn't have a role in the actual delivery of fire services or law enforcement services, but you do have a role in the administrative and external affairs component with dealing with your citizens because ultimately, although the sheriff's office is a service district and we provide services regardless of whether it's in the city or out, and fire district is the same, ultimately, though, you know, we have the same bosses, and that's the citizens of the community. So,
in a plan, though, how do we get contact? Because I think that's one of the things.
Yeah.
Now, they, because we have an active council,
mm-hmm.
they don't need to be invited there, they show up. But I think partly you wonder, when you trigger the emergency operation plan or the or you're going to open an emergency operation center, in that call list, I'm assuming there's 10, whatever you have in the plan, anywhere does it say in there the city representatives of that city or the mayor of that city or and since Alpine is the newest city, one of the concerns has been that these plans, you update them, but a lot of the plan have been around for long before Alpine was here. And are we getting included in there to where, in fact, you do call the city government and the mayor is notified and so on when you open an emergency operation center? Because I don't know, well, again, individually one of them might have been called because they happen to know somebody, but I mean, I'm talking about in the plan, does it say
so
we would be notified?
You know, so the Deschutes County plan, that's probably a gap between, it's kind of fallen by the wayside in between Alpine and the county plan is because the county in some, or we do provide a lot of the public safety services that typically kind of trip those alarms, so to speak. It kind of just goes on, and we don't want it to go on without you. But I think that's where kind of a city-specific plan probably needs to focus on what Alpine provides services for and then maintain an updated call list of those to call. You know, the other thing you have, we actually utilize our EOP. We don't actually activate an EOC very often.
Mm-hmm.
It's a scalable response, so quite often it's a law enforcement supervisor.
Don't use the acronyms. you use EOC, EOP.
Yeah. Sorry, Emergency Operations Center. Thank you for catching me on that. And Emergency Operations Plan. So we don't necessarily, we always are operating within the spirit and the framework of the plan. But actual declaration of an emergency is where you really get into the nuts and bolts and you really go through the plan. The rest of it is kind of just standard operating guidelines. And so if there's an actual disaster that occurs inside the city of Alpine and requires city to do a declaration, that's where I think we do have a gap in the fact that really the city has to do that declaration before the county can do
it. I think more we're talking, that I would consider that it's more of the fires of 2 miles out of town, they open up, Red Cross takes over the Parks District and they bring in cots and all these things are happening inside. So it's not that the city's calling the disaster or something, because these fires are you know, like, you know, in Sisters, the fires aren't in the city of Sisters. They're miles out of town. But they set up these centers there, so it affects schools, it affects everything. So I think the question isn't that you know, I'm not so worried about one starting inside the city. It's when you guys decide to do all of this, how do we get notified? Other than they happen to just drive down there. And that's been a beef of the city council for since I've been here.
Well, I'd be happy to address that and figure out a really...
I want to see it, I guess, in the plan where it says that you notify the city of Alpine, or it could be in any of it, you notify the city of Bend, or whatever city you're dealing, but I guess I've never seen that in writing yet, and I want to know, do they have our phone number? Do they have the mayor's phone number? I mean, that's a basic question. Yeah. Do they have the president of the council's phone number?
Well, I bet by tomorrow we'll make sure that it's in there. It may not be in the plan per se, but it can certainly be in a...
well,
sometimes those things don't go in the plan. You don't necessarily want them all in the plan, because every time position changes, I think what you need to do is maintain a call list, and
but what triggers the calling on the call list?
That's really based incident specific. So it's not, there's not a specific formula that this happens and you call this person. If it's a fire and it's affecting certain populations, you want to include those folks that are involved. And so we're just kind of undertaking a project, and we'll make sure we find out who the right appropriate people are in the city of Alpine, but to develop a joint information system, which really kind of handles a lot of that process. So that manages information both to the public, but also to other stakeholders.
And we'd be no different than Sisters, because actually the sheriff's office handles law enforcement, and they have a rural fire district.
Right.
So whatever you've done in Sisters on numerous occasions needs to be done here.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know what that is.
Yeah, so... typically, those relationships happen organically, and that's kind of been my experience. And so being new to this position, we'll just have to make sure we know who the right people are and get that information disseminated to them. And I think where that comes into play is make sure that the appropriate person is invited to tabletop exercises and role and simulations so that you can be ingrained into the system. And you know what an elected official's job on a incident varies from community to community. Also, you know, some are very hands off, some are very active, and then wanting to kind of find that balance between not being too operational, but being more of an elected official and play that elected official role rather than. So I think we need to work on that. I think we'd be happy to probably host maybe even a mini tabletop for the city to kind of talk about.
Well, you know, the public plans. Works. We have, you know, the fire department needs water, and he gets them through the 10 to 12 inch water main. Our reservoirs, if they get drawn down, we've got to crank pumps up. We need to know all those things.
Yeah.
Because so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of times, you know, I think what probably has happened is we've relied on our public safety response personnel here to know who to call, and I think that's probably a bit of a gap in the system. Mm-hmm. And so I think probably what, you know, if the fire department has a relationship with the city very well, not that we shouldn't have the same relationship, but, you know, I think we expect, well, if they need water, they know who to call public works. But is that notification being done in the right way and in a timely fashion? So
I think I agree with the city manager. We've all had a concern around this, and we've sat through several years of talking about it. I remember many of the meetings that we had 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. For a year, we talked it to death. And I think it's important that, and I'll use the Burgess fire for one. I think Stu heard about it from being in Red Cross or some of those people, but I never heard a word. And you know, we've got, and until it had already gone on for a while, I think we have a responsibility to our citizens who have a concern to be able to have at least some contact point that knows what's going on.
Yeah.
And I agree it ought to be written down somewhere.
Yeah, I think the problem is you don't necessarily want to put that in the EOP of who and what the number is. One, that's a public document. You may or may not want that out there, although a lot of times city councilors put their phone numbers out, and that's fine. But then again, that's just one more document you have to maintain. What I do is I do maintain a call list, and I will get the right numbers to update that.
Sure.
So it's happened, and I'll leave you, I'll make sure you, and I think you have my cell phone number, and so if at any time, 24 hours a day, I sleep with my phone, you have a concern that you're not getting information, you can call me. That's one of the roles I play in the county. I'm really a liaison between agencies, so. I think
one of the reasons it probably happens to us is because we don't have fire and police direct. Mm-hmm. Redmond, you know how the city finds out that the police department's involved? Chief is notified,
right.
And the chief knows I'm going to call the mayor, or I'm calling the city manager. See, that's the same with Ben and everything, so it would only be us and really Sisters where, and even Sisters has a much larger public works department. I mean, up until 2 years ago, we didn't even have a public works employee. So there's no criticism.
Yeah.
We just want to make sure it's all updated.
I think that's the kind of the growing pains of a newer city and trying to kind of establish yourself within the community and then the community of other communities and kind of establishing your place and
right.
Getting people used to, you know, for when I worked down here as a patrol deputy, there was no government other than the county. And so I think we're still in that mindset of rolling with it's just us. So, you know, probably we should have a conversation and typically what we do is, you know, the cities would notify a city manager and then it's up to you
right.
to decide if that's something worth waking up a mayor.
You call me,
counselor.
You got a while to wake him up.
Yeah.
If you notice, I mean, in these snowstorms on the East Coast now, you know, you can't hardly get, you know, the mayor's out there ahead of the snowplow.
Yeah. yeah.
If you haven't noticed that, they're out there.
I expect to see that next snowstorm, by the way.
I'm waiting for him to ban travel.
Yeah.
The mayor declares a travel ban in Lapine.
I can
Cascade East
Trails. Yeah. I appreciate your concerns. I think this is a pretty easy fix. We'll get it.
Okay.
We'll get it wrapped up. I think at some point we'll kind of develop what appropriate notifications are, and that's always a struggle. You know, even when I worked at Redmond PD, very rarely did we notify city manager of events. Now, there were certain, once in a while, you'd go, oh, I should have done that, and you regretted it. But, you know, it's kind of that finding the balance of you know, trusting staff to do it and then making sure that, you know, you don't want to get a phone call from a citizen that's really upset over something we did before maybe Rick knows about it. You know, I mean, I think that's, I get that. You know, having been a manager of an agency, you know, I get that completely. So I think this is an easy fix. I think we can have it, at least a system in place by the end of the week. So that's the biggest concern right now.
The other thing, when we were going through all those talks, they had said that the city would be a command center, and that there, if they would have to be phone banks and everything put in. Do you know that ahead of time, or is it just as an emergency comes to you? Pick a spot. Are we supposed to be prepared for something if that is the case?
I think it is it's advisable to have a facility that you can set up either an emergency operations center or a command post. So one thing is the distinction between the two. So typically what we end up setting up are incident command posts, because it's a command function. So we're managing an incident. An emergency operations center is a coordination, plays a coordination role. Typically that's set up when there's multiple incidents or an incident so large that a command post can't really manage the resource requests and the information requests is happening. So I think we should identify, and that's something we can do jointly, emergency operations center in Lapine, and I think...
You could be your own building.
Yeah.
You have generators, your radios, you have a big building over here.
Right, so I mean, I think that's something we can do. Typically, I can tell you, the last time we actually opened a full-scale emergency operations center was 2008. So it's not something we do very often. We do a lot of command posts, and that's where you have to be, you know, and that's where it's a command function. It's an operational function rather than a coordination function.
And now, so the Forest Service may set something up, but maybe it's not even driven by you when they have a coordinated big event.
Right. So the Forest Service typically kind of has a pretty it's kind of a facilities in a box, so to speak. So you, as they scale there through their fire season, typically they have a dispatch center in Prineville,
right,
that manages the dispatch for this area, and that's basically essentially is the EOC during the fire season. They can set up an expanded dispatch if they start getting incidents that are really tapping their resources to provide resource requests, and then they have what's called a MAC. There's the Northwest MAC out of Portland that manages resources, large resources, you know, that they're bringing in from across the nation. And then they can set up what's called a sub-geographical MAC, which we had one last year for all the complexes out of Prineville and So when they have all these really big fires going in an area, they might set up what's called a sub-geographical multi-agency coordination center.
Yeah.
Thanks.
We all speak thin.
Yeah, I apologize. So maybe you guys just need a little taser collar for me. Every time I say something with an acronym, just shock me. So, but that's kind of how they do it. And we don't do that so differently, but I don't want to use the term routine, but it's a regular occurrence that they're putting those into place. In Deschutes County, most of our large emergencies are wildland fires. So we really kind of piggyback the system that the Forest Service and Oregon Department of Forestry already have in place to manage those. So typically our EOCs are, we utilize, I mean, we're a cooperating agency to their problem.
Sure.
So we don't always set up an EOC or emergency operations center, but we might depending on the circumstance. And last summer during the Two Bowls incident, we utilized the EOC facility for the Joint Information Center, another FEMA Fed term, I apologize. And that's that where, you know, we had Deschutes County, the Sheriff's Office, Oregon Department of Forestry, obviously
City of Bend,
and all these Bend School District, because when we evacuated two schools three schools, I think, were within the evacuation area, and it was still during schools during the school year, which was atypical. Most big fires are not, you know, they're usually July, August. So we had a lot of information to be able to manage and put out to people and be able to keep elected officials up to date. And that's where that JIC, I hate to use it, but it's a lot easier to say Joint Information Center, so I'll end up saying it anyway.
Yeah.
That's where that really comes into its own. That's where your elected officials, because you don't want your elected officials out on the fire lines. It's not particularly safe for them. It's not particularly, we don't want them getting, you know, feeling like they have to charge down there because they're not getting enough information. We need to have a system in place to make sure that that information is given.
I think that's what they want, is information, yeah, so they can relay it to the
right.
Publicans.
Yeah.
And otherwise, they just listen to Barney Larkin and see what he's got to say.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to think that our elected officials should have at least, you know, the information 5 minutes ahead of Barney. So we'll try to do better about that down here. So, you know, this is Allison and Ed both actually have been involved in the Joint Information System planning. And so it's new. I shouldn't say it's not new.
It's
new to us. And frankly, to be honest with you, it's new to a lot of places. So we're kind of testing the waters, and then make sure you let me know who, if that's you, to contact if obviously it's within this area. I mean, that's who I would anyway, so.
Well, you can call me 24/7 too, so.
Okay. Sounds like we have a perfect relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. But I do think it would benefit maybe get some city staff and some of the council available. We can walk through kind of a scenario. Maybe we could even put together a quick, just easy little maybe 30-45 minute scenario. Maybe a wildland fire. Maybe something else. You know, you have two transportation corridors that go through your community: a rail line and a highway. And frankly, we didn't talk about those in the National Hazard Mitigation Plan because that's not covered under that. But your transportation,
you have a derailment.
Yep, your transportation accidents are, that is a threat to your community, and so that's a situation that, you know, we also keep an eye on and monitor. So there's a lot going on. So
at COIC a couple of months ago, they were talking about probably the same thing, and they were saying when the valley all drops off in the ocean, what are we going to do with all those people heading up to the mountains, and can we sustain everything to keep it all going?
I think our concern, our number one concern, should be ensuring that our population, our public, is prepared to go without for 2 weeks at minimum. Because it'll be less of an issue of, I think there's, we will get some migration from a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. But A, will they be able to get here? Was their car fueled when it happened? Because if it wasn't, they're not getting any fuel. Are the transportation corridors open? Because we all know, especially depending on the year, they're unstable at best, you know, whether it's landslides or bridges or, you know, the integrity of the highways. So actually getting them here, and, you know, we've kind of, I think, finally successfully over the last year, I've been really vocal advocating with Oregon Emergency Management to really abandon some early plans on there being mega shelters in Deschutes County, because A, we don't have the resources to manage doubling our population, was what one person at one point an estimate was, when the reality is we'll be suffering ourselves because we'll be without goods and services for much, you know, for the early stage of that event. Not to mention the response to that event will come through Central Oregon, so a lot of our facilities and resources will be taken up by that role. So I think people are finally getting that they want to keep people home if they can, and support them in their home. And if they do have to transport people out, that probably Central Oregon, a population of 200,000 or so in the Tri-County area, you know, isn't a big enough metropolitan area, especially when the fact that our grocery stores are empty and we don't have fuel and all these things, we're probably not a big enough area to, you know, so really Boise, Salt Lake City, Denver, Spokane, Los Angeles, you know, these large metro areas outside the Cascadia region are probably a more appropriate place to relocate people if that's what they want to do. And I think FEMA's kind of on that. They get it now, so I hope so.
Yeah.
We do have a large-scale Cascadia exercise planned in June of 2016, so we'll see how that goes. Not
I
sure.
I went to the one, they did the one at the Tower Theater. They did it. They've done a couple. There was some, they're speaking about the that Cascadia. I think it's harder to get people. They kind of, they watch it, but most people kind of, if you figure it's only going to happen once every 1,000 years, and these are people that play the lottery, they just figure, oh, well.
I think this one that Nathan's talking about is actually the accumulation of getting the Cascadia event and the resilience plan to a point that they can actually gather some usable data from having an exercise.
Yeah.
And I know the mayor in Redmond is head and toes in that, you know.
Yeah, George is heavily involved in the Oregon Resiliency Plan. Yeah. I talk with him regularly because every time something on Cascadia comes up, I think I'm on a speed dial. he's very energetic in that, and I think that behooves our region to have somebody like him kind of be a firebrand, so to speak, for us, because that's kind of what George and I and then the emergency manager over Kirk County, we've kind of teamed up on the fact that we need to explain to them, if you're going to use us for this to help support the rest of the state, then we need help ahead of time. You can't just like put a dot on a map and say, okay, this is our incident support base and we're good to go, you know, because that's not reality. So what is our infrastructure needs to so we can be capable of supporting the rest of the state?
And you're right. The big thing here would be even not called not the worst earthquake, if anything real bad or a volcanic eruption is, we won't get gas. Mm-hmm. We won't get those fluids.
Right.
It'll have to come in from Boise. It'll take a while to shift around.
Yeah.
And we can bring it from the east,
but
travel over the Cascades, you know.
Yeah. It's that redistribution of those supply chains. It'll take some time to work through, and you know, everybody's going to be competing for these resources, and so really that's where the focus of our energy has been. And of course, you know, like you said, you know, it's in one ear out the other for a lot of people, a lot of apathy, unfortunately. But you know, if you can just get people to be prepared to be take care of themselves,
well, it was a couple, 3 days.
Well, you know, so you have a 72-hour kit.
They keep adding days, more like 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah, so the 72-hour kit has kind of been the I don't want to use the term gold standard, but that's kind of been that's been what they have said for years, and that's because it's reasonably achievable. And I think the point was, as well, you're better to have 72 hours than nothing.
How many of you are ready for 72 hours? Can you stand that?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure she can. Yeah.
You know what? Actually, probably all water would be the thing I'm sitting here thinking. I mean, I got enough food. I mean, I can food, drink. I got enough whiskey.
Yeah.
But I think...
I know where I'm going. I'm going to access. I know he's ready for his desk.
You know, I think it would be drinking water that I don't... You know, like 5 gallon jugs in my garage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We do.
And the dog food.
We have the trash cart.
Yeah.
You know, that's full of rice, beans, and some of that other
stuff.
So there's a whole list. There's several websites around the country that will provide you emergency list.
Well, the Mormons want for 60, 90 days. Yeah. I mean, there's people that a year. Some there are religions that plan for a year.
There's a number of faith organizations that are by far more prepared than the
We need to push that, because one of my pet peeves is, you notice whenever there's a hurricane or something, I mean, it's almost, talk about speed dial. I mean, the hurricane, I mean, the trees are barely blowing and they're on their cell phones calling, why isn't FEMA here?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I've been without power for an hour. Where is FEMA?
That is the other big component, is setting realistic expectations for the public to say, you know, you'd like to think we're going to ride in on a white horse, you know, with, you know, I Need a Hero playing in the background, and you know, that's what we like to think of ourselves, but that's not reality. We need the public to understand that the more you can take care of yourself, the better off you'll be, but it also help redistribute the critical services to those who need it most. You know, those people in your community that are not able to take care of themselves, whether it be due to poverty or medical condition or functional access needs, age. Yeah, all these different things that make a certain components of our population much more vulnerable than the other. So those who aren't in that vulnerable population really kind of do have a little bit of an ethical obligation to be able to help themselves and maybe even help their neighbor that it can't, because I think developing community resilience, that's where it starts. It's that you go down the street and Mr. Smith can take care of himself, and he knows that Mrs. Jones down the street, who's 90 and lives by herself and doesn't have any family in the area, that he's going to go check on her when the bad day happens. And I think that's right. That's really where you develop your community resilience.
Yeah. I think this idea of somewhere down the road, sitting down and seeing, you know, just around the tabletop and looking at the pieces from all the way from information to the level of service for any category of need would be available, or how we would deal with it, or even just think about it. So, somewhere.
Yeah, I'd be happy to help facilitate that.
Okay.
And, you know, I think probably...
You've got his phone number.
We'll make it happen. I think periodically I'll just put me on the agenda to come visit, and if you have anything for me, beat me up again. That's
I used to be
in a punching bag.
Well,
that's my job.
You were the new guy, you know, and they did have a vacancy there for a while, and we were kind of caught in all of that as they were, you know, moving people in and out and everything else. So it's good that you're there. You know.
Well, I'm happy to be here. So.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for coming.
Absolutely.
Ed, Allison, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. And I'm going to leave my goodies here.
Okay.
I need to go rescue my husband from my toddler.
I'll leave a few cards too.
Thank
you. If you want to take them.
So,
I think there's enough. I'll leave a couple extra. You can use them, give them to the deputy that pulls you over.
Yeah.
I don't know, they might double the fine, but I can't guarantee the results.
Where was that?
Trying to get these people tickets now.
Use it at your own risk.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, who we've got? Right.
What is it?
Well, have a good night. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thank you.
Give it to the deputy and really get this
great. Yeah, really good.
Yeah, I don't like this guy.
You know,
take
I'd like
my big fan's maps.
Let's recess for 5 minutes.
Ashley, you have water at home?
I have water, but.